We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In 1998, a British physician, Andrew Wakefield, published a paper in The Lancet, that is Britain's leading medical journal. It was a paper that suggested that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine could cause autism. It was a paper that was speculative. However, in his public pronouncements, Dr. Wakefield went much further. He actually recommended that parents not vaccinate their children. And many people heard that and took that advice. There were questions raised about this work almost immediately, but those questions didn't get as much attention in the media. Now, eventually, the work was judged to be so problematic that The Lancet withdrew it. Dr. Wakefield lost his license to practice medicine in Britain. And in fact, allegations have been made that not only was he simply wrong, he had also engaged in professional misconduct. But it is still something that causes a lot of people to be fearful, and there are still a lot of people who are avoiding, or at least very hesitant, to have their children vaccinated. We'll talk this morning about this story and how it developed and how it was covered with Seth Mnookin. He's authored a new book on this. It's titled The Panic Virus. The subtitle is A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Seth Mnookin is contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's also the author of two other award-winning books, one about media and one about sports. Hard News is about the plagiarism scandals at the New York Times. The other, Feeding the Monster, is about the Boston Red Sox and their transformation into one of the most successful sports teams in the world. He's joining us by telephone, and as we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send along your comments and questions by email, you may do that as well. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We do hope people can be brief in their comments, but they are certainly welcome. And Seth Mnookin, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I think it's interesting your way into this, as you have explained. You started looking at this story in 2008, I believe, and you explained that you were newly married. You didn't have any children at that point, but you knew a lot of people who did have young children. And that this was a subject, this whole business of vaccination certainly came up when you were talking with your friends who did have kids. And the thing that really struck you was that people were uneasy about it. Maybe they were actually saying, well, you know, we've decided not to have the shots for their kids. And that there were people who went in other areas when it came to topics that maybe had something to do with science would have had much more respect for science and the process and the research. But on this particular case, they were not approaching this in an equally rational manner.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what struck me. And it struck me even though at that point I really had no idea of where the evidence lay. I just assumed that it did lie on one side or another. Because this was not a debate about which there seemed to be a lot of middle ground. There weren't people who were saying, well, you know, maybe vaccines cause autism. There seemed to be one group, primarily parents, who believed that vaccines had injured their children, who felt very strongly that this was definitely what happened and what could happen. And then another group comprised much more of public health officials and medical doctors who felt the opposite. And, you know, as someone who spent his career as an investigative reporter, I was definitely willing to believe that there was a conspiracy going on here at sort of how, you know, it's my bread and butter in some ways. But what sort of hooked me was these friends of mine who were saying they were making decisions, what seemed to me like a very fundamental decision about their children's health, based on a sort of gut instinct and intuition. And these were the same people who, if faced with an argument that, well, global warming can't be going on because we got 4 feet of snow this winter, they would respond, that's ridiculous. You need to look at the evidence and look at the science and not base your conclusions about something like that just on what you, quote, feel to be true.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think as you have pointed out, that at the beginning you tried to approach this with an open mind, and you say that you were perfectly willing to consider the possibility that vaccines might indeed be causing problems. And you admitted that, like other people, you would at least also be willing to consider the idea that drug companies didn't necessarily have our best interest at heart, or at least they were in the business to make money.
Right.
And that this, I think that this is an example where a story hooks into a generalized feeling that a lot of people have, that big business, science, government aren't completely to be trusted.
Yeah, and I think, one of the many things that's interesting about this, or at least interesting to me about this, is in order to believe that both vaccines are important and that there is not a risk of their causing autism, you don't need to say, well, I think drug companies always have my best interest at heart, or that the government is always trustworthy, or because clearly over the last 5 or 10 years, there have been many instances in which we've learned about drug trials that where initial results weren't confirmed later on, or where there were questions about authorship. But this is a topic that has not only been studied by pharmaceutical companies themselves, but also by independent researchers and scientists, as well as by public health officials, as well as by governments, other governments and public health officials around the world. So I think in this case, we can look at the totality of the evidence and feel confident that we're not putting our faith or putting our children's health in the hands of Merck or SmithKline Beecham or some other drug company. We're relying on a whole bunch of information from a whole lot of different sources. Mm.
At the same time, though, I think the difficulty here for the medical community in talking about this is, for example, you're at your pediatrician and the pediatrician says, okay, here's the schedule and it's time to get these shots. And so a parent says to the doctor, well, look, doctor, can you give me a 100% guarantee that this is safe and that if we give the vaccine to my child, there will not be any negative outcome? And of course, the doctor would have to say, well, no, I can't give you 100% guarantee about anything.
Right. And I think you put your finger on a really, really crucial point here, and something that I think not only is something that comes into play on this specific issue, but around so many things involving science and public health. And that's that just a fundamental reality of the universe is that there are no guarantees. I can't guarantee that tomorrow I will not wake up and be able to fly because I haven't experienced tomorrow and we can't predict the future. What I can say is that we have an enormous amount of data and evidence that all supports the notion that human beings can't fly. And because of that, I have an extreme amount of confidence that will continue to be true in the future. I think that's a concept that doesn't really get communicated when the media is reporting stories to the public. And so you're dealing with scientists and public health officials who are sort of trained to speak in this very careful academic language. And so when they say, according to all of our data and information, we feel secure that vaccines do not cause autism, that qualification sounds much more frightening than it really should. And you know, one of the results of the fact that this has been such a preoccupation for the last 12 or 13 years, this supposed connection between vaccines and autism, is that that issue probably has been explored and investigated more than anything else related to vaccines. So, you know, if I was going to say anything about vaccines, and I do think there are cases in which children can have vaccine reactions, but I feel as secure as I possibly could that the results of those do not include autism.
Yeah, and I think also you make the point that, in fact, you could argue that we, in putting so much resources into trying to answer this question that some people would have said was fairly settled some time ago, that
right.
we're taking resources and putting it into continuing to try to answer that question, where maybe we might more profitably be putting those resources into some other question.
Yeah, I mean, another thing I think that one of the reasons why this really has had such resonance for the public is because we still don't know a lot about autism.
Mm.
You know, it's something that has received a lot of attention, deservedly so, and I think as a society and certainly parents are much more aware of it than they were 20 or 30 years ago, for a number of different reasons, including the fact that rates seem to be going up. But we can't say, okay, well, this is what causes it. Here are effective early interventions, or even here are effective ways to diagnose it early on. So when you have all of those uncertainties, I think that really fuels people's fears. And one of the tragedies of the fact that this is something that has been such a fixation is that I think we've lost years of research, energy, and money and time that could have been spent investigating other potential environmental triggers or other ways to help families dealing with, in many cases, extremely difficult situations. This, unfortunately, has become a topic that is so divisive that I have spoken to you know, a fair number of researchers who have said, you know, it's just not worth it to me to sort of step into to this arena. You know, I want to be able to do research, and I want to be able to do it without dealing with protests and hate mail and all of that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Seth Mnookin, and he is contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and his new book is The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. That is the subtitle, and the publisher on the book is Simon & Schuster. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go back and talk just a little bit about the original paper, the study that Wakefield did and that was published in The Lancet in 98. But what's, I think, really striking here, one of the things you point out is that when The Lancet published it, the editors at Lancet apparently were concerned enough about this article so that they went out and sought other scientists to review the piece and then published what they said, essentially debunking in the same issue the
right.
paper that now has caused so much controversy since.
Yeah, it was, and I talked with both of the authors of that, of the commentary that The Lancet had commissioned when the Wakefield paper initially came out, and one of them said to me that you know, he had never known of a situation in which a journal had commissioned a commentary essentially to explain how bad a study that they were publishing was. You know, normally, if you're going to run a commentary, it's to say, oh, well, we have this incredibly important new research that we think people should pay attention to. So there were pretty clear indications and flags right from the start that this was, at the very least, a paper about which there were reasons to proceed with caution, or to make sure that you did not draw large-scale conclusions from what was both a very small study, a study only involving 12 children, and a study that a lot of people had very serious concerns with right from the get-go.
Well, given that fact, did you ask the people there at The Lancet, did you say to them, look, if you had such concerns about this paper, why did you publish the paper in the first place?
Yeah, and, you know, it's a very interesting issue because I actually come down on the side. I think I'm more sympathetic to The Lancet in that regard than a lot of scientists are, and I'm more critical of the media's handling than a lot of scientists are. So it seems like it might be a situation in which, you know, I'm more comfortable critiquing my industry and they're more comfortable critiquing theirs. But my general feeling about that is that there should be a fair amount of latitude to publish studies that are, that might not pan out, that leave something to be desired in terms of the totality of their evidence. That's how science sort of evolves and proceeds. You get fits and starts, and you have studies that are later debunked, or you have studies that initially didn't seem very promising and end up leading to a very promising avenue of research. So in my most sympathetic reading of this in regards to The Lancet, the place in which this really kind of went wrong, the original moment of sin, if you want, was a press conference that Wakefield held, or the hospital that he was working at held, and he was the star of the press conference, announcing the results of the paper, in which he said something that was much, much different from what the paper itself had said. And he told parents in this press conference, with these questions that have been raised, I cannot in good conscience recommend parents to continue to get the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. That was an absolutely outrageous thing to say for any number of reasons. That was also a press conference that The Lancet very conspicuously refused to participate in. So, I do think that there's definitely a good argument to be made that if there were that many concerns about the paper, what was The Lancet doing publishing it in the first place? But I think given the fact that they published it, they did as much as they could to sort of to telegraph to everyone, this is something that should be interpreted as very, very preliminary results.
Well, just I have some callers here, I promise. I will get to them. But just one more follow-up point. I think that it's important to stress the point that that the paper that Dr. Wakefield was a gastroenterologist, and he said, as my understanding in the paper, he said, well, I think that it's possible that the vaccine could cause some problems in the gut, in the gastro system, and that those problems then could cause autism. But he was indeed very, he didn't come right out and say it. It was a speculative kind of thing, and that there was indeed this big jump between the speculative nature of his paper and his coming right out and standing in front of a bunch of reporters and saying, I would say to parents, my recommendation would be don't have your children vaccinated.
Yeah.
It wasn't even borne out by the paper that he had published.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, he said, and he was not the only author on the paper, he was a lead author, and so I guess he and his co-authors said in the paper, we have not identified a biological mechanism through which this might work. So, we're not even saying that we think this is how it might happen. All we're saying is, isn't this interesting? And I think, just one point that I think really needs to be made about this is that, as you said earlier, a lot of new information has come out about that paper in the 13 years since, including the fact that Wakefield had a financial relationship with a law firm that had been working with parents who believed their children were injured by vaccines, including the fact that he had taken out a patent for an alternative measles vaccine. As a result of some of these, he has since lost his medical license in the UK, and the paper has been officially retracted. But what I think is very important to sort of realize about this is, even if none of that had been true, Even if, you know, these ethical accusations had never been brought up, this was a 12-person case series. And you never would make conclusions about anything based on 12 people. You know, an example I use is anyone who knows a family of 10 or 11 or 8 kids, you know, and there are 7 or 8 boys out of those, you would never take that number and then say, from this, I conclude that 80% of the population is male. The most you would ever do is say, oh, well, this is sort of interesting. We now need to expand it and look at the population or look at a much larger group. So, you know, it's not only the fact that he hadn't identified a biological mechanism through which this could occur. It's the fact that drawing those kind of conclusions from a 12-person case study is just absolutely outrageous.
Hmm. Well, we have some callers here. Let's talk with them. We'll start with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have two reasons for not getting a flu vaccine shot. One is I'm leery of the long-term consequences of a vaccine circulating through my body in 5, 10, maybe even 20 years. And secondly, even if those influences are benign, the possibility of recombining with any other chemistry or my own individual chemistry could prove deleterious to my body. Can you reflect on my opinion?
Sure. And I certainly understand those concerns. And I think, you know, it would be wrong of me or of anyone or of doctors to not take the concerns of people about the flu vaccine or parents about different vaccines that their children are gonna receive. I think part of the reason that we don't have, as the public, we don't have good answers to some of those questions is I think the medical community and the public health community has done a very poor job of communicating precisely how vaccines work and the risks of the diseases for which we're being vaccinated for. So when we get a flu vaccine, that's an inactivated flu virus. So there is not a chance that you're going to then get the flu from that inactivated flu vaccine. The number of antigens and viral particles in vaccines is minuscule compared to what we encounter every day. And that's because our knowledge of immunology and the sort of exactitude with which we've been able to identify the precise amount needed to spur an immune response has grown vastly in the last several decades. On the flip side, there are tens of thousands of people every year who die from the flu or die from complications of the flu. You know, that's just a reality. And I think it's important to, at the very least, be aware of the risks of not getting those vaccines. And one more, and I suspect this is probably going to come up again with other callers, but one point that I want to make, and I think it's really crucial that this become part of the conversation, is that when someone does not get a vaccine, for a given disease, that obviously is a personal choice. And I would not make prescriptive recommendations about laws or even guidelines related to that. However, I think that it is not honest of individuals, of people, then not to acknowledge to themselves the risk that they're putting other people at. You know, infants are not instantly vaccinated, and that is the period at which we are most vulnerable to a lot of these diseases. The elderly, there are times when they can't be vaccinated. And you know, we are seeing the resurgence of vaccine-preventable diseases. And as a result, we're seeing deaths. And 10 kids died last year in California of whooping cough. So when you decide not to vaccinate, I think it's also really imperative that you at least acknowledge to yourself, you know, maybe there are legitimate reasons, maybe there are not legitimate reasons you're doing this, But there are consequences on people besides you.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. We have some others. There's someone here who's on a cell phone, so I really want to get to them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling from a cell phone, and I got to leave in a few minutes. But you've just addressed one of the questions I was going to ask about the damage done to other peoples by not vaccinating for the three childhood illnesses. My grandson was born and grew up around San Francisco, and there's a large population there who decided not to vaccinate their children. Dr. Wakefield did his work very well. So I was questioned, how many people do we know about that suffered from the diseases that the children were not vaccinated for? And two, if at age nine, perhaps you could answer this, if you could persuade the population that it's all okay right now, would the vaccines have any efficacy with the children at that age?
Those are both excellent questions, and I'll take them in reverse order. Yes, vaccines, you can get the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, later in life, and it will be effective. In fact, there's one vaccine, the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine, that adults regularly get, and we regularly get boosters. Everyone probably has had a tetanus booster at some point in their life, and we're increasingly learning why it's so crucial to also get pertussis or whooping cough boosters. To the question about some of the costs, the health costs to other children, I think the best illustration of that, the best recent illustration of that in California is a measles outbreak of a couple of years ago that began when a deliberately unvaccinated child was infected with measles while on vacation in Switzerland. And that child happened to be living in a community where there were also a large number of other unvaccinated children. Before the end of that outbreak, before that was contained, there were dozens of children who had to be quarantined. There was one infant who was too young to have received the MMR vaccine, who was hospitalized. There were eventually 11 further infections that were positively identified. And this cost close to $200,000 to contain. So there are, very, very clear, identifiable consequences. With the whooping cough outbreak that's been going on recently, most notably in California, but across the country, and there were over 5,000 cases just in California last year, that is not something that has originated in unvaccinated childhood populations. It seems that the two reasons why that has become so powerful, that outbreak has spread so much, is because of under-vaccinated adults who haven't received boosters, and because we're still not entirely sure about the length of the immunity that the whooping cough vaccine delivers. I think what that does very clearly illustrate is the risks to your children if you choose not to vaccinate. Again, 10 kids died, and 9 of them were under 6 months old. So that's a situation in which I don't think we can say this is spreading because of unvaccinated children, but it certainly highlights the risk of not vaccinating your child. Yeah.
Well, again, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. I want to say thanks and to invite others. If you have questions, you can join us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And if you would like, you also can send us your comments and questions by email. That's will-talk at illinois.edu. Our guests in this hour, Seth Mnookin is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and if you'd like to read more on this subject, you can look for his recently published book, The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. Just real quick, again, to round out this issue about adult vaccination, I think it's really striking that, particularly when it comes to pertussis, whooping cough, that now the recommendation is indeed that adults get a booster for the pertussis, and it's packaged. It's the DPT, the same thing, I guess, that kids get. And now the recommendation is when you go in every 10 years to get your tetanus booster, if you're doing what you should, that you're going to get this. And the thinking was that that there actually was a lot of pertussis out there, that adults were getting it, but for them it wasn't all that serious. But the serious thing is that, well, they could pass it on to a child, and then it would be much more serious. So I think the medical community judged that there was this reservoir of pertussis out there in adults, not a problem for them, but a problem for children. And so they said, well, okay, we think that adults should also get the vaccine.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You know, what's really interesting, or one of the things that's really interesting, is with this pertussis outbreak, it also seems to have been more serious in adults. You know, one of the reasons that whooping cough has been so underdiagnosed is because a lot of times if you have a cough, a sort of lingering cough for several months over the winter, you might not go get a blood test. It might not be sent to a state lab. And so you would then never learn that you have whooping cough. You know, my mother actually was infected last winter with whooping cough, was misdiagnosed at first, and ended up with a severe infection for months, and actually broke four ribs through her coughing. So there is a sense that one of the reasons this has spread is because, A, we haven't been aware of the number of cases out there, and as a result of not being aware, we haven't realized how crucial it is to get a pertussis booster. And in fact, I didn't know that I didn't have my booster until I started working on this and had to get it from my pediatrician.
Well, I want to come back to another aspect, which I think for you is a very important aspect of the story, and that is how the story was reported. You have a lot of criticism for the media and the way the story was covered. And again, going back to, we talked about the fact that there was that The Lancet, this British medical journal, published this study by this British doctor, Andrew Wakefield, in 1998. It was this very speculative study based on a very small sample. And he made the suggestion, well, maybe there was a relationship between the MMR vaccine and intestinal gut issues and autism. And that The Lancet, the editors of The Lancet, were concerned enough about it that they actually went out and commissioned people to write then other articles to review that work that essentially said, no, we don't think that that's right. And that then subsequently, though, that the doctor, Dr. Wakefield, held a press conference and made statements that really went rather far beyond what he had done in his paper, urging parents not to have their kids vaccinated. Now, so the question now is how that gets reported. Now, that was a big story, got a lot of attention, and no doubt the reporters did go out and interview doctors or public health officials who said, well, something to the effect of, well, we really still think it's important for your kids to be vaccinated, and we believe that there's every reason to believe that it's safe. So why was it, though, that this story took off and the medical opinions didn't seem to carry the same weight that Dr. Wakefield did?
Yeah. Again, it's you definitely are identifying what I think are the crucial issues here. And, you know, one of the themes I wanted to touch on in my book is how the ways that we receive information, how we decide what to trust, and what we think of, you know, expertise. And obviously the big lens through which we get a lot of that, even today, is the mainstream media. And what I found so objectionable about the coverage of that initial of Wakefield's press conference when he told parents that he couldn't recommend the MMR vaccine is when I spoke to some of those reporters, and ask them why their stories the next day said, you know, researcher recommends parents not get the MMR vaccine. Other doctors disagree and presented this sort of on the one hand, on the other hand, false equivalency. When I asked them why they did that, they said, well, who are we to make that kind of judgment, especially on a daily deadline with a couple of hours to file a story? I understand that clearly in those couple of hours they can't go and review all of the research, going back 10 or 20 or 30 years. But the issue that we touched on earlier involving not making those sort of conclusions or recommendations on a 12-person case study are issues that's something that I think every journalist writing about science should understand. That's not a really complicated notion. And I think the legitimate questions to ask at that initial point in those stories for the next day is, you know, why is it that this researcher is making these recommendations? A, based on such a small sample. B, despite the fact that clearly the journal that this was published in had a lot of concerns. C, despite the fact that at the press conference itself, the dean of the medical school with which Wakefield was associated got incredibly upset and started banging the table and saying that what Wakefield was telling the reporters was wrong and irresponsible. So I think those would have been legitimate topics to cover if they felt like they were going to have to report on this. Then the justification that, well, they had corrective stories in the years to come, although in many cases it literally took years, if not more than a decade, to issue those corrective stories. That doesn't cut it with me. It's sort of like the old, probably apocryphal story about two political candidates, and one says, well, I have no reason to suspect that my candidate beats his wife. Once you put that out there, then that's what people are going to be thinking about. And we very clearly have seen that in this case. Once that fear that vaccines cause autism was introduced into the population, as it were, it's been very, very difficult to get rid of that, regardless of what the evidence says.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello there.
Yes.
I hope that you can make some little comment on, in Champaign-Urbana, the occurrence that we had of a cowpox occasion and why it wasn't recognized. And also more comment perhaps on tuberculosis inoculations, which in this country are kind of horribly frowned upon, but there's a great increase. In fact, locally, we've had a tuberculosis case. It takes a couple years to cure up from it.
I don't know about the cowpox situation there, and so I can't speak. I can't speak to that. Certainly, one issue has historically. Regarding diseases that vaccines have been particularly effective for, and polio is a good example in this country. One issue is at what point do you stop vaccinating a population if that disease has stopped appearing there? And polio obviously is present in some parts of the world, but it hasn't, for the most part, been in the Western Hemisphere for some time. So that's an issue that vaccinologists and public health officials struggle with all the time. Despite what some people seem to think, the public health community has no desire to give more vaccines to children or to anyone than is needed. So that's an ongoing conversation that people have. But unfortunately, I don't know anything about the cowpox situation.
Well, there, I also can't say all that much about it. I do. It's my understanding here, and I'm actually right now looking at the webpage of our local paper, just to try to refresh my mind about it. And it was a case where it was a student lab worker at the University of Illinois that was infected with cowpox last year, and you know, no doubt in the course of doing their work, and apparently it was treated, and at least as of a few late last month, apparently this person is fine, so it doesn't. And I guess I thought that cowpox was not a hugely serious thing, although I guess it's maybe related to smallpox, is it?
Well, cowpox is what's interesting about cowpox is it was really the first example of someone identifying a kind of relative of a disease that could confer immunity to a much more serious disease. So the first vaccines really developed by Edward Jenner and others were the smallpox vaccine that was developed through cowpox. So the reason that was done is because cowpox was much, much less serious than smallpox, which was often fatal. I don't know the treatment options for cowpox among humans, but you know, even just the fact that the student was treated and then seems to be doing fine, it shows how different that is from smallpox, which incidentally is the first disease in the history of the world that we've been able to completely eradicate from the population.
And I know you actually have some of the book is that it looks at the history of the development of vaccines. I guess as I recall, the observation was someone observed that people who worked around cows and who as a result got cowpox were more resistant to smallpox, so that then they thought, well, that's interesting. What would happen if we actually intentionally gave people cowpox? Would that make them more resistant to smallpox if they were?
Yeah, that's you remembered exactly correctly, and it was such an interesting case. You know, Edward Jenner, among others, realized that milkmaids who occasionally had cowpox blisters on their hands from milking cows and getting infected, didn't show other indications of being sick, but actually never seemed to get smallpox. And there were some popular rhymes at the time written about how, you know, fair milkmaid skin was because they didn't have the telltale scars that people got from smallpox. And so that's then exactly what happened. Edward Jenner injected or actually smeared cowpox pus on an open wound of a young boy, and he did not get sick. And then when he was given a similar treatment with the smallpox virus, he also didn't get smallpox.
Yeah. Well, also the caller did indeed call back and follow up because he also was interested in having you say something about tuberculosis.
Yeah, that's another. I actually don't know about TB specifically. I know that there are TB resistant strains, but it's something that again I can't comment about specifically or intelligently, just because it's not something I've looked into.
Okay. Well, again, we just have about 7 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Seth Mnookin is our guest. His book is The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear, published by Simon & Schuster. We do have another caller in Urbana. We will talk with them on line two. Hello.
Perhaps I can throw a little light on the cowpox issue. Smallpox is a very innocuous disease. I grew up on a dairy farm in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, you just said smallpox.
You misspoke. You said smallpox. I think you meant cowpox.
I said meant cowpox.
Right.
If I said smallpox.
Right. Yeah, right. Okay.
I have never been able to get a smallpox vaccine to take. Apparently, I've been infected with a cowpox, although I was never ill with it. I never knew any of my neighbors who was. But we, most of us, were apparently had a high degree of immunity for smallpox. It was thought at one time that cowpox was the ancestor of smallpox, that it had evolved from it. But I believe current theory is smallpox probably evolved from camel pox, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
The problem
I'm not surprised you didn't get the smallpox vaccine, because that's not given anymore.
Well, I'm thinking of 50, 60 years ago.
Right.
When it wouldn't take. I mean, I was vaccinated two or three times, and it never got a reaction. So I assume it wasn't taking, because I was already immune.
Right.
The problem with the TB vaccine, I believe that question came up, was it was ineffective. But it also made it impossible to use the skin test to identify an active case of tuberculosis.
Right.
It was very widely used in Asia and the Middle East. And students that come to our university now often will react to the tuberculosis skin test, although they're not do not have an active case of tuberculosis. I hope that helped a little.
Yeah, no, that does help. And I just looked on the CDC site, and you did a very good job clarifying exactly what they said, which is that the TB vaccine is generally not given in the U.S., but is given in countries in which TB is more much more common. And one of the problems with it is that you may then have a positive reaction to a TB skin test, which would make it difficult to diagnose, because it's not actually due to a TB infection. So
we're coming.
Thank you for clarifying that.
We have maybe about 5 minutes here, and I just want another point I want to come back to. You know, as you pointed out, we've discussed, as a result of reporting on this issue of are there problems associated with vaccines, going all the way back to Dr. Wakefield and his 98 paper, many people have decided that they would not have their children vaccinated. And you have said, and it has been reported, that as a result of this decline in childhood vaccination, some of these diseases that we hardly saw started to make a comeback. And so, for example, as you said, we'd seen outbreaks of measles and people dying of measles, which just was kind of unheard of, at least in the industrial world. Now, there has been, again, I think people have tried to report on this and said, well, we really don't think that there's a problem here. And as we have said, just last year, the Lancet withdrew the paper. And this year, earlier this year, there were some stories about people making charges that, in fact, that Dr. Wakefield had engaged in scientific misconduct. Having said all that, do you see any sort of a turnaround in the way people are thinking, in the way parents are thinking about this whole issue of whether or not they get their shots for the kids?
Well, you know, it's one of the reasons that I called the book The Panic Virus, and it's something we touched on before. And that's, I think, even when there is corrective information or better information, it's just so hard to unscare people. You know, as an example, take the razor blades in Apple's story. I don't know anyone who would let their child have an apple on Halloween, but in fact, if we did all give children apples, we would probably be much more healthy as a result. So right after these latest fraud accusations came out in January, there was a Harris poll taken, and still only 52% of the people polled said that they believed that there was not a connection between vaccines and autism. Another 30% weren't sure, and 18% thought that there could potentially be a connection. So I think the conversation is beginning to shift. Certainly, I think the media coverage is shifting, but I think it's going to take a while for the kind of general consensus or the general feeling among parents to catch up to that. What I hope it does not take is more stories of children getting really sick, you know, children being hospitalized because of measles or dying because of Hib or whooping cough. I hope it doesn't take those type of personal stories for parents to start to realize that not vaccinating is not a risk-free proposition. You know, we're not dealing with either you vaccinate and then face these theoretical fears that really have been disproven, or you don't vaccinate and there's very little risk. You know, I'm a father, and every time I talk to a parent whose child was either made incredibly ill or died, it's just absolutely heartbreaking, and all the more so because it's so unnecessary.
I have some of the hearers came in as an email, and I'll ask you the question. They want to know, why does you feel it's important to keep a timely and frequently updated errors page about your books on your website? Which you do. There's a corrections section, and
yes,
the listener says, why not just wait either for the next printing or just ignore the critics?
Well, because you know, one of the things I really, really believe in is that we as journalists have responsibility to give as accurate information to the public as we can. And when we make mistakes, we should be as vocal about it and as prompt in issuing corrections as we possibly can be. You know, in a 110,000-word book, I definitely do not have such a high opinion of myself to think that there are not going to be mistakes. And I've identified mistakes. I am very grateful when readers identify mistakes. And so in addition to correcting all those in future editions, which clearly I will, I want there to be some place where readers who have this version can go very clearly, and it's clearly labeled on my website, and say, oh, okay, well, you know, actually Bruno Bettelheim was not an MD, he was a PhD, because I don't want people then to repeat things I got wrong and have those errors sort of further spread. So, you know, it's a question I get all the time, which is, why would you bring attention to mistakes you made? And I guess I feel like if we didn't have that kind of that perspective or that approach or that attitude about very understandable mistakes, everyone would probably be better off, you know, if we just sort of came out and said, I got this wrong and I wish I hadn't, but here's the what's actually right. I think everyone would be better served.
All right. Well, for people who want to read more on the subject, again, the book that we've been talking about is The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Our guest, Seth Mnookin, is contributing editor at Vanity Fair. And if you're looking for the book, by the way, his last name is spelled Mnookin. And thanks very much for giving some of your time today.
Thank you so much. You can also, if you don't remember how to spell it, you can also actually just go to thepanicvirus.com, which is probably easier to spell for people.
All right. Great. Thanks.
Thank you so much. It was a great conversation. I really, really appreciate it.